Session number 10814 or 2.
Mr. Asia, Reel 2. So this period was a period of training and your commissioning into the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, but can you tell me how you came to join HMS Nelson, which I think was in February 43?
Yes, certainly. The having been selected by Vice Admiral A.U. Willis as his flag lieutenant, for reasons which I still am quite unable to comprehend, I was requested by him to report, fully packed, kitted out, at Paddington Station to meet him, his coxswain, and his secretary, a man called Commander H.S.P. Watch, R.N. And the idea was that we would go by train down to Plymouth, where we were met, and there to board a Catalina flying boat and fly in the Catalina from Plymouth to Gibraltar, which is precisely what we did. I think for most of the journey, I forget how long it took now, most of the journey we flew at quite a low altitude for reasons which must be obvious, with the German Condors and indeed other aircraft coming out from occupied France on the lookout for the likes of us or anyone else for that matter. Joining Nelson in Gibraltar, of course, never ever having been on board such an incredibly large ship in all my life, was a novel experience, to say the least. The retiring admiral and his staff handed over, and I proceeded to take over the duties of flag lieutenant to Admiral A.U. Willis, flag officer commanding Force H.
What does a flag lieutenant do?
My job, which is really to some extent comparable to flag lieutenant today, was to organise his program, to arrange meetings for him, to organise to some extent his social and military life, and to generally be around and do whatever was required, liaising, I think, with the various staff officers, and to a lesser extent, of course, with the flag captain, a man called Captain the Honourable Guy Russell, and Commander Blundell, who was the commander of HMS Nelson. Some people have said, "Oh, it's just a general dog's body." Well, that is not true. Some people might like to think it is, but it was a relatively important job, handling signals, although not actually trained as a signals officer, because today, and indeed during the war, there were flag lieutenants whose job it was to be not only flag lieutenant and doing the jobs that I've explained, but also to look after all the signals in that. I played some small part in that, but not being a trained signals officer and having a qualified lieutenant commander signals officer on board attached to the vice admiral staff, that was not really necessary. But to liaise with him, of course, and to feed the admiral with various reports all the time was an important part, of course, of my job.
Can you tell me about Nelson itself, about some of its characteristics?
Yes. As I say, an enormous ship with 9 16-inch guns. I'm going to jump ahead a little, if I may. The function, really, was to guard, I suppose, the eastern approaches, or or rather the western Mediterranean and the eastern mid-Atlantic areas. We used to go out into the Atlantic occasionally, but more often than not we would ply between Gibraltar and a place called Merzel Kebir, which is very close to Oran. We played quite an important part there, meeting with the French, who of course were well established there. We then went on to Admiral somebody or the other died, and Admiral Cunningham, who was CNC Mediterranean, flew back to London to take over the job. I suppose it must have been First Sea Lord. Yes, the First Sea Lord. Admiral Cunningham came back, and my Admiral, who was second in command, Mediterranean Fleet, although he was Flag Officer Commanding Force H, we moved from there, from Nelson, to Algiers. And we were ashore in Algiers for a while. Then we moved again to Malta, again on dry land, but rejoined Nelson more latterly. And the coming back to Nelson, what she did, first of all, firing the 16-inch guns in anger was the most extraordinary experience. It is true we'd had practice shots, so one knew that the whole superstructure shook like hell and paint fell off everywhere, and one could see, in point of fact, not the actual projectile leaving the gun, but within a second or two after that, one could literally see the shell shooting out and travelling its 20 miles or whatever it was. The only time the guns were actually fired in anger whilst I was on board was bombarding Reggio Calabria, which is the southern end of Italy. Living in Nelson, as I say, was a wonderful experience, I think, really. Living down aft, a life which was quite novel to me, of course, having my own steward to look after me, and just generally looking after the Admiral, making quite sure that he had the right food and wines and was just well cared for and looked after by all concerned. In Nelson, obviously I was invited to meals and drinks and one or two midshipmen's parties and things like that, which again gave me an insight as to what went on in a large ship. I mean, the ship itself, as we all know, with her sister ship, the Rodney, with whom we were together on many occasions, was a vast ship, which was built in the early 20s and had to be foreshortened because of some idiotic convention at the time. And so when you look at HMS Nelson, and I have some prints here of her by Wiley, some etchings of her by Wiley here, you can see that she's foreshortened. She should be much longer aft and have another gun turret there with three 16-inch guns. Instead of that, the convention said that ships built at that time should only be of a certain length, so they had to chop something off the stern. The Germans didn't take any notice of that, as we all know.
Was she a comfortable ship to live on?
Very. Oh yes, very. Although she was relatively old, I suppose, very comfortable indeed. And as I say, my experience really was only aft in what's called the cuddy, in other words, the Admiral's quarters there. But we used to have meetings there, and obviously when one was in harbour, calls were made by visiting admirals, generals, people like that. We, in fact, were at Malta at the time of the Italian surrender, when the fleet surrendered. And again, I've given some of these photographs to Dr. Downing. And that was an incredible experience, really. Seeing the Italian fleet all lined up and at anchor off Valletta Harbour, and of course my Admiral, being the senior officer, actually took the surrender of the Italian fleet at that time on board HMS Nelson. I remember going to, on board the one of the Italian flagship, and first of all, from a distance, thinking what beautiful and graceful lines they had, and going off, stepping on board and being received right royally, and going down below and seeing pictures on the bulkheads, carpets everywhere, marble busts and aspidestras, thinking to myself, yes, no wonder you buggers don't want to go to sea. You're far too comfortable living in these sort of surroundings. Fascinating, really. I suppose they stowed them away. I mean, you know, yachts today have things like that on board, but when you go to sea, you stow them away somewhere. So I suppose that was only for harbour purposes, but very different and I think more attractive. But we were relatively Spartan, of course, in the Royal Navy. But then the Americans, of course, even more Spartan. I mean, they had no carpets, no alcohol, no pictures, no nothing. All they had was lots of ice cream and Coca-Cola. They seemed to fight quite well on that.
But the Italian fleet made a spectacular sight there.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, a memorable sight, one might say. Yes. And lovely-looking ships. Ours were more rugged and, you know, somewhat older. Many of our ships, of course, were that much older, like Nelson and Rodney. It was a fascinating experience.
It's interesting what you said about comfort, though, because it's always said, in making a comparison between the Royal Navy and the German Navy, for example, that the Royal Navy ships had to cater more for the people on board. They had to be more comfortable because of sailing the seven seas, which the German Navy, by and large, didn't have to do.
Well, someone has the advantage of me over that. I haven't been on board a German capital ship, but I don't think that the Royal Navy it certainly wasn't luxurious, but it was what I would say, what I would call comfortable, one wasn't so Spartan as the Americans, and certainly not. Nothing like so luxurious as the Italians. I suppose one could say that really it was a halfway house between the Italians and the Americans. Really, I never thought, in fact, that anything on board Nelson was particularly luxurious. Let's put it that way.
Jumping ahead yet again in the war, you then changed from one end of the fleet, as it were, to the other end, to very small boats. If you can tell me how that came about, please.
Yes. Having left Admiral Willis, who was then a full admiral, and came back to London to become second Sea Lord in charge of personnel, he said to me, "Well, Flags, can I help you in any way? Would you like to go back into destroyers?" And I said, "Well, it's very kind of you, sir, but I think I'd rather leave destroyers and play some part in smaller craft, motor torpedo boats or something similar to that." And as a result of talks and one thing or another, I found myself going up to a place called HMS St. Christopher, which is at Fort William, for training. Now, the training before one went into any small boat was in, as far as I'm aware, as far as I was aware, you started off in motor launches, B-type MLs. And I was there training, again, having various courses, brushing up on various procedure, and more importantly, ship handling, because they obviously needed to know how they handled. Having spent a couple of months up there and having a week or three with the training flotilla, waiting for a vacancy, I was then posted to Dover, where I joined an ML flotilla. I was with them for about 3 months, I suppose, really, at the time of D-Day. And our job at Dover was to steam up and down, more or less the middle of the channel, I suppose, letting off smoke to screen the various convoys that were coming through to supply the army, navy, and the air force at Haramanches and the beachheads in Normandy. That I remember on one particular occasion when the bombing from the Germans, Cap Grenet, one, I don't know the size of the shell, but it must have been pretty large, hit one of the troop carrying vessels of about 10,000 tons, I suppose, not once but twice, which is the most terrible sight. And we spent the next few hours picking up bodies from the sea, which was a most unpleasant business, and rushing them back, those who were still alive, rushing them back to Dover to hospital. After that, I had a few weeks on board an MTB. Very little action, really. We used to go out up and down the coast, escorting various convoys that were going backwards and forwards, as they were ceaselessly at that time. And then I was detailed off to commission MTB 758, which was building at Alexander Robertson's on the Clyde at a place called Sandbanks. And I was then sent up there as the first lieutenant. That was a most interesting experience, really, because I had never been there before. When I told my father this, he said, you obviously don't realise, but Yeoman 1, that's the boat he built in the mid-30s, in fact, has been laid up at Alexander Robertson's yard. And when you go up there, you'll find her there, which is precisely what I did. The man who was in charge, the man called Boyd, I remember, who subsequently designed one of the 12 metres to try and recapture the America's Cup in 1958, unsuccessfully, as it happened. Anyway, the commissioning of MTB 758 happened. A fellow called Lieutenant Bramwell, Freddie Bramwell, DSC, was my commanding officer, and he appeared after a week or two, and gradually all the crew collected together, and we then set off and went down to Holyhead, which was the working up base for motor torpedo base. Well, I think we must have been there for about 6 weeks or something of that sort, exercising with and without other MTBs in and around that area. Great fun, very interesting. Freddie Bramwell was relieved of his command for health reasons, and a chap called Tom Rakeen, RN, lieutenant, took command. And shortly after he joined, we set sail for the East Coast. I remember the first port of call was Falmouth, and then from Falmouth to Ramsgate, and Ramsgate to Great Yarmouth, where we were based. Shortly after being based there, the fourth officer, we had four officers on board, was moved to another ship, and Edward Ducan joined the boat at that particular time. And as I said to you earlier, we've been great friends ever since. We had a pretty rugged time on one occasion when we actually left Great Yarmouth and were based for a few weeks at Ostend. And on one occasion, we were due to come back to, I think it was Felixstowe, for a refit. And I happened to be ashore, and I was buying some lace, some Bruges lace for my mother. And suddenly, it was the middle of the afternoon, suddenly I heard the most terrifying noises going on, banging and rockets going off right, left and centre. I thought, I wonder what the hell's going on. Rushed back to the ship and discovered that in the little fisherman's harbour at Ostend, which housed the short boats, a Canadian flotilla was in there, and I think one of our flotillas was in there, and someone somehow had thrown a lighted cigarette end over the side. They had been pumping bilges, which was a natural thing to do, and the surface of the water there had obviously been covered in high octane petrol. And suddenly, apparently, the whole place caught fire, and there was the most God Almighty conflagration, and everyone tried to sort of scramble out as fast as they could. our boat was there with one of the junior officers on board and managed to get away, but we lost five of our crew. Bodies were never recovered. I think there must have been, I think they said, all in all, there were about 45 lives lost for one reason or another. You know, boats blowing up. Nine boats were actually blown up. You can imagine that you only have to have a fire, 100 octane on board, rockets on board, ammunition on board, wooden boats, two sets of three ply, of seven ply, stuck together. That's what formed the actual hull itself. And some of these boats were incapable of moving because they were all jammed in. And it was the most terrifying sight. I rushed down. By the time I got there, there were boats up and around and burning. There's nothing that I could do. Eventually, our boat came back, minus, as I say, five crew members whose bodies we shall never... Well, I had to write, you know, sad letters to their next of kin and try and tell them what had happened.
Was sabotage suspected?
No, oh, no, 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 no. I think it was just downright carelessness on the part of someone. Smoking was not permitted except in certain areas. And certainly, if you went down into the engine room, you had to wear rubber soles because of sparks and things. Because, you know, with 100 octane, it's you don't need much to set that off. Because the MTBs were engined by Packard aero engines, and each one was 1,500 horsepower, and they ran on 100 octane petrol, aero fuel.
Perhaps at this stage, could you say something about the... you just started telling me about some of the characteristics of MTBs.
Yes.
Could you tell me more about those characteristics? I mean, you're talking about the use of plywood in construction.
Yes.
And so on. But can you tell me more about its characteristics, especially in comparison with the motor launches, which you were on previously?
Yes. The motor launches were slightly smaller. D-type MTBs, and this is really what I'm talking about. MTB 758 was a D-type. The basic difference really was, whilst the D-type were slightly larger, 116 feet overall, they were a hard chine boat. They, in fact, were faster, much faster, about another 10 knots faster than an ML. MLs had two engines. The D-type had four much more powerful engines, and as a result, of course, they were used for offensive purposes rather than the B-type MLs for defensive purposes, if you like. The various categories of B-type MLs, being round bilge, slower type of boat, there were two categories there. The harbour defence motor launch, which again was smaller. Then there was the B-type. With the MTBs, you had the D-type, which were the largest, and then you had two other types. You had a Vospa and and the power boats. They were slightly dissimilar, but about the same length, 71 foot 6, approximately, both those two. So that you had... All the MTBs were hard chine, the Bs round bilge. So that was the basic difference, really. B type slower, more comfortable, used to roll more, in a seaway, very sick making, really, especially when the engines were cut and you were rolling around. Mind you, the Ds weren't very much better. They were beamier and, as I say, slightly longer, more heavily armed, the MTBs, of course. We carried four 21-inch torpedoes. We had two quite powerful guns. We had twin Oerlikons and 0.5 machine guns either side of the bridge. Complement three or usually four officers and about 22 crew, of which, of course, four were motor mechanics to look after the engines, and the rest were either seamen, gunners, people. We used to live on board. People used to live on board B-type MLs, but the short boats, they were too small for anyone to live on board. So when they came back into harbour, accommodation had to be found, of course, for them ashore, whereas we all used to live hugger-mugger in the D boats. But very pleasant, really. The captain had his own little cabin. The officers, the other three officers, had a little wardroom, double bunk and a single bunk. That's where we used to eat, live and have our being. A little entertaining. And as I say, I've made some very good friends from those days, rather than my flag lieutenant days or my HMS King Alfred days, although I say I still have one or two, but not so many. I suppose it's natural, really. One lived closer to one's chums, and one got to know them better and either loved them or loathed them. There was some in both those categories, as you can imagine.
And presumably there must have been practically no resemblance between serving in an MTB and serving in a capital ship.
None whatsoever. Yeah. I mean, obviously there were basic rules, but it's rather, one, I suppose, likens it to a fighter pilot in a Spitfire, or a member of a large bomber, you know, the more people. And it's a different kind of job, it's a different kind of mentality too, really. I think when the cut and thrust, I think, really, of being one's own captain, if you like, and being closer to the action in an MTB is of course vastly different being a small cog in a very large wheel in a capital ship. You know, you won't have your job to do. Going back, you know, one in a capital ship, you have to have chaps to load guns. You have to have chaps to load guns in an MTB, but the scale is somewhat different, obviously.
Now, if we can pick up the thread of your story after this accident at Ostend, please.
Yes. Well, coming back to, as I say, we lost these five chaps, and that was great sadness. And many other people died. So those boats that were damaged, and we were damaged, had to come back for a refit, and we had a refit in Lowestoft, actually. It was Lowestoft. After that, we then came back, recommissioned the boat after 3 weeks or whatever it was, came back, and then went back to Ostend, where we back to Great Yarmouth, where we carried out our various duties of going across every night to the enemy coast and looking out for small coastal craft, or indeed large coastal craft, or indeed to be called up by a monitoring destroyer or corvette or whatever larger ship was there to control the movements of the smaller motor torpedo boats. In other words, you know, every night a flotilla or a number of our boats would go across to the other side looking for the enemy and being in constant touch with the controlling, as I say, destroyer or corvette or larger ship, whatever it was, so that if they needed reinforcements, if they detected any particular activity, midget submarines, shall we say, small coastal vessels,